The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Brad Stotz. Brad is an associate professor of operations at the University of North Carolina's Kenan Flagler Business School. His work has been featured in many publications, including the Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, The New Yorker, The Financial Times, The Wall Street Journal, and NPR. He has a new book. It's called Never Stop Learning, Stay Relevant, Reinvent Yourself, and Thrive. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks so much for having me on today.
You open this book with a pretty bold statement. You say, quote, "We're bad at learning, supremely bad. In fact, we're our own worst enemies." So why are human beings so bad at learning?
Yeah, well, that's how I spent the last 15 years of my life trying to make sense of that. I think, of course, like most things, the answer is complicated. But probably the simplest form is there's a whole lot of things that we do in the short term that help us, you know, survive this moment in time, but actually don't position us so well for the future. And so time after time, when we take that kind of short-term focus, we maybe, you know, do what we should for this moment and then run ourselves into some pretty big issues down the road.
We talk to a lot of behavioral scientists on this podcast, but I found it interesting that you're not just coming from that POV. You write in the book, quote, "To investigate the topic of learning more deeply, I decided to situate myself between two academic fields, operations and behavioral science." And I found that really refreshing throughout the book because it wasn't just about human behavior, but it was also the sort of operational element. And I'm curious, like that, if you can explain to our audience what's different about coming from that intersection for this POV.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's somewhat accidental, frankly, that I came at it initially from kind of that operations and engineering mindset. And mm-hmm. I think my view was that, hey, learning's a problem, and if we just put the right processes in place, we can fix it. And I think that the biggest difference I find coming at it from kind of that operations mindset as opposed to the behavioral science is that I start with the outcome. You know, what am I trying to achieve, and then working my way backwards? And I think that, you know, as you were just saying, what I came to appreciate was that while the processes are really important, so too is the behavior.
Yeah. And
so kind of working backwards from the outcome, thinking about the process, and then you run into this issue of, hey, even though we know we should follow a certain process, let's take failure, right? We should be willing to try things, have them go wrong, learn and move on. You know, we don't. What is it? And this is where the behavior creeps in. And so I think that, you know, if we really look at how do we use the power of behavioral science, it's we match it with good processes and we recognize that those two things need to kind of fit hand in glove. That process without the behavior is going to be unrealistic, and the behavior without the process, great. Now I understand what I'm doing wrong, but I have no idea, you know, how to move forward productively.
And before we jump into things, and I definitely want to talk to you about failure because that's so core to improvisation, the environment we're in, the reason this is important relates to, in some ways, you have some really interesting statistics that sort of cite this, because there's so much talk in America about losing jobs to foreign markets, but you note that from In a period, there was only 13% of manufacturing job losses were due to foreign trade, whereas 87% were due to productivity increases. So we're kind of doing this to ourselves as opposed to outsiders coming and taking away these jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important, you know, piece to recognize is that, I mean, the world is changing so rapidly right now. And you know, we really are doing a lot of it to ourselves, that if you look at kind of the big drivers, things like artificial intelligence, things like big data, you know, productivity improvements, et cetera, we're getting better and better and better, which in many ways is great. It means we can now produce enough food for the world, or you know, we can get the various things done with a whole lot less labor. But then the question, both organizationally and individually, is how do we reallocate that time, right? Yes, we just got better. We can now cut something by maybe in the extreme 90%. Mm-hmm. Well, can't we find a way to use that 90% so that we produce even more, so that it's not kind of dystopian, instead that we move into a better place? And at the end of the day, that's a story of learning, that you know, we take what we knew before, but we build on it to invent that new future.
And there's limits to, you know, learning everything. You quote an estimate that a physician would need to read 29 hours a day to stay current with the literature, which is not just impossible, but that also speaks to this need for specialization.
It is, and I think that's something that we've seen. I mean, certainly Adam Smith, you know, talked about this hundreds of years ago,
right,
with the idea that, hey, if we specialize what we do, then we get better and better, we get gains from that, and we can trade off. And we absolutely see that, that, you know, the specialization is getting tighter because of things like the medicine example. And the good news is we can share that knowledge we have, you know, not just with the local community, but now we can share it around the world. Now, of course, that also means we're competing with people around the world. Mm-hmm. So if we're not learning and other people are, then we're going to fall behind. And so I think, you know, all of these, you know, fit together as we look at kind of that process improvement or the routinization, the specialization point, you know, globalization. So we think about digitization, as well as then the need to integrate it all together, means that we really are living in, I would suggest, a learning economy. And so kind of our success or failure as we move forward in whatever it is we're attempting to do comes down to how fast can we learn.
Yep. All right, let's dig into failure, because this is a thing that we know in our field in improvisation, which is so much of the work we do early in improv classes is getting people comfortable with failing on stage and building up their sort of resilience and grit to keep at it. Because we know when you are making a script up out of nothing, you are going to fail a bunch. And in fact, what we discover over a period of time is often those failures lead to really interesting and funny results that can turn into successes. You write, progress is not only two steps forward, one step back, but often running in place or backward or sideways. So set the groundwork for this. You know, what is it about our attitudes towards failure that are making us not learn?
Yeah, so, I mean, failure, I think, is endlessly fascinating, because at some level, we all get the fact that learning requires failure, right? That you're going to try stuff and you can't get it right the first time. You know, but I think that, but there's a little piece of us that's saying, but what if I did? What if I'm the one that, you know, just everything went flawlessly, and then I can be the star? And unfortunately, you know, while occasionally you get lucky, that over time it doesn't work that way, right? It really is this slog, that it's not, you know, the Big Bang occurred and now, you know, our protagonist has won, but rather we go through that hard, painful, slow process. And then unfortunately, you know, I think there are a couple of big problems that we actually face with failure. One is just an inherent fear of it. And I think mm-hmm. this in some ways is what you're talking about, of getting people comfortable, right? That failure can be embarrassing, can lead to shame and anxiety, that there's been research done to show that we activate similar sensors in the brain when we fail to physical pain. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of, oh, gut punch we feel sort of is our body responding as if it really got hit. And unfortunately, we tend to overemphasize the negative elements of things, that when we think about taking that risk, when we think about putting ourselves out there, trying the new thing, you know, right away we think of, well, you know, it doesn't work and I'm going to be embarrassed and shamed and people are never going to listen to me again. So that bad tends to overpower the potential good of pushing our way through trying it. And as you're highlighting it, then on the other side, we actually see that, you know, we've created something special out of this.
Yeah.
And so that's the first big challenge.
Mm-hmm. There was an interesting quote from the book where you say, since failure is to some degrees a surprise, it makes us change our assumptions. And what I loved about that is this is a thing we know in both improvisation and comedy. So there are two different things, of course, but a lot of improv leads to comedy. And comedy is often, if you think about what a joke is, it's usually a surprise. You think something's going to go one way and it goes another way. And I've always tied that to like, oh, that's like divergent thinking. That's the ability to sort of like make that sort of, you know, you laugh at it and then you realize that, you know, you've learned something. So you're kind of talking about that here, right? That surprise is connected to learning.
Absolutely, right? I mean, because if we're just doing the same thing over and over again, then where's the surprise? We know how they're going to connect. But the issue is that so much of the world is altering around us, including, you know, our competitors or whomever we're you know, dealing with, that, you know, if we don't surprise ourselves, they're going to surprise us. And probably not in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. And what happens when you talk about your failures, when you open up about your failures to other people?
Yeah, it's really important because the second big challenge that we have with failure is that we often actually fail to see it. So unfortunately, when something goes wrong, instead of recognizing it for what it is, that it's a chance to learn, we try to explain it away, right? Oh, you know, this is how I wanted it to go all along. We're trying to protect our self-image. I love the quote from Richard Feynman, Nobel Prize-winning physicist, who said, you know, the first principle is you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool.
Right.
And so, you know, I think where we start when we actually call out our failures is, you know, that appreciation that it really did occur, that it's really there. And, you know, in doing that, we start to destigmatize it. Mm-hmm. We bring it out into the open. Because I think the funny thing is, in teaching and working with, you know, whether it's, you know, students on campus or executives around the world, you know, that if you really get people talking about failure, I've yet to meet someone who, nope, you know, I never fail. That's never an issue here. Then, you know, you spend enough time and that we all know it's part of the process, right? I love Ed Catmull in his great book around his story of Pixar and talks about how mistakes aren't a necessary evil. They aren't evil at all. They're an inevitable consequence of doing something new. And so when we share those failures with others, you know, we're making it okay. We're showing them of, hey, look, this is a part of the process. Now let's move it in a positive direction.
And let's talk about process, because this is very interesting. You write, at its core, learning involves understanding what and how inputs affect important outputs, building a model of the way things work. I haven't really thought about it that way, but indeed, when you start to think deeply about process, you know, you might be underestimating how many inputs are going into what would be a successful process, right?
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think it's helpful to take that model building perspective a little bit. And in this world we have of increasing big data and analytics, you know, there we're formalizing it, right? Mm-hmm. We're creating mathematical models that try to predict an outcome as a bunch of X's. But pull back and think about kind of the really careful decisions we make, even if we're not sitting down and using data. You know, in our head, we have some idea of if I take this action, you know, my competitor won't be able to respond, or the customer is going to buy the product, or my boss is going to be interested, or whatever it might be. And that's a whole lot of what learning is about, is it's building a better model.
Mm-hmm. This, as a theater producer, which I've done for most of my career, one thing we know is that you are every step of the way that someone looks at an ad or calls to buy a ticket or walks into your theater is setting the context for how they're going to experience the production. And it seems very, very obvious in a theatrical context. I love that you do a study about a dining context, in particular Benihana, which I am semi-obsessed with that whole experience, because, you know, certainly growing up and I loved going to like Benihana restaurants, and we were on NCL cruise ships forever and they had a similar experience. So can you talk us a little bit about the awesome process that is Benihana?
Yeah, no, I think Benihana is a wonderful example of this, because I think for most of us, we just experience Benihana as this fun show, this meal that is both familiar but slightly exotic as kind of our chef is performing in front of us, and kind of we leave sated, feeling good about the whole experience. But if you dig into Benihana and you think about it from a process perspective, it turns out you know, that they were brilliant in constructing this. In every step along the way, they thought about, okay, okay, how do we batch you the right amount of time so you wait just a little bit in the bar, so you have a drink and a half to prepare yourself for the meal, so now you're in a better mood, and then we're going to sit everybody in a group of eight at a time. That way, we never have empty seats at the table, and so you avoid wastage that way. Then from a meal standpoint, if you think about it, you know, the construction of the meal is actually incredibly cheap, right? Things like rice, things like zucchini, your cheap vegetables, and the amount of meat that you get is very small, but because it comes at the end, you feel like you've just been swimming in food, and so you leave, right, kind of sated. Then, you know, we have the chef who's performing in front of us, which is great entertainment, but it's also a really efficient use of resources. Now we're not wasting space in the back having to have kind of an entire kitchen. We are using our entire space to seat diners. So we fill up all of our tables. We use all of our restaurant space. We're using fairly cheap ingredients, though giving you this rich experience. And back to this point of it, you know, especially when it first came out, it feels like, oh, you're having this authentic Japanese experience. But if you look at the meal, it is decidedly, you know, kind of traditional Americana, as you have your chicken or your steak with some vegetables and then throw in the rice. And so kind of that whole, you know, putting it together, even it used to be that at the end, to make sure you'd leave, they would clean the grill with ammonia. And so that ammonia would leave kind of a little bit of a smell. Right. And no one would want to sit there and stay at the table. Is a great example of, you know, building a better model. And so most of the time we may not get it down to that level of detail. But I think my guess would be in many of your kind of theater production examples you have, and that even though to the audience it feels like this entire surprise, you have it kind of down to the second.
Yeah, I was at this dinner with a bunch of behavioral scientists who are working in the sports field, and they were talking about they got hired to work for one of the teams in Chicago, and they attended the show, game. They were handed a gift when they went in, and you know, one of those, like, the first 10,000 guests get a, you know, whatever, a towel or something. And one of their recommendations afterwards was like, hey, you know, one of the problems with handing the gift when you come in, I think you're trying to get that people to come in early, but then you've got to sort of uncomfortably hold this thing, and then you're not getting the joy of leaving by getting a gift, which would carry on the experience after you left. And they wouldn't take the suggestion. And in my conversations with Richard Thaler, he's constantly trying to get sports teams to take his advice, and they won't do it, even though he's got data and science behind it. So, I think this idea you talk about, like, you know, that we are so focused on the outcome that we are losing our eyes on the process and the importance of that, because you just think outcome, outcome. And that we're not going to learn from that.
No, we're not. And unfortunately, it gets back to this, you know, why are we bad at learning?
Yeah.
And it's because we think that, you know, hey, we are judged solely on the outcome. And maybe in this one moment in time, this second, okay, fair enough, we're being judged on the outcome. But life isn't just one outcome, right? It's this succession time and time and time again. And so it's that in between, right? I mean, I think, you know, sports are a great example. You know, any NBA fan has heard, you know, the 76ers mantra of trust the process, right? Which is all about this. It's saying, hey, we've got a model. We think this is going to build a team that will be a winner. And, you know, things were bad enough that we have to sort of pay our dues and work our way up. And you can move to other sports and see the same sort of logic playing out. But I think that, you know, the challenge for us is seeing it in sports and recognizing, even if you're not a professional athlete or coach or whomever, that it applies to our lives, too, that we have to think about that process of how we get from A to B. One of Taylor's students, you may know, Cade Massey, has a quote that I absolutely love, where Cade says, you know, the world would be a lot simpler if people understood variance even a little bit. And I think that's fair, that unfortunately, you know, we want it to be a clear connection from A to B, and sometimes you do everything right and it just doesn't work out. And the takeaway needs to be, great, keep plugging away and it'll work out next time. And sometimes, you know, you don't do things right, you get lucky, and God bless you, but you better not, you know, count on luck as your strategy all along.
It's fun to read your book, especially now we're in, I think, the third year of our collaboration with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth that links improvisation and behavioral science, because, you know, I work with Nick Epley and we had Francesca Gina on the podcast. And so you're working with people that we kind of know their stuff. And you have this, a whole section on asking questions, which is, I've had so many conversations around this. And one of the very first meetings where we had a bunch of the UFC behavioral science scholars and Second City improvisers in a room, was they were sort of like, well, show us a classic Second City exercise. And we did this yes and exercise, which most people understand this about if they even rudimentarily know about improvisation, where we have people improvise by saying no, and then by saying yes, but, and then finally by saying yes and the yes and of course feels better. And their challenge to us is like, but what when it's thorny, you know, what do you do then when you have a true disagreement? And so after a period of time collaborating with the scholars, we came up with this idea of thank you because. And you get to this in the book, this idea that if you want to stay in a difficult conversation, you have to truly, literally thank the person with those words for their what they're saying to you. And then the because part is crucial, where you then need to describe what they just said to you, allow them to interrupt you so you get it right. And then at least they feel seen and heard. And if they do that for you, you're going to stay inside the conversation. But that requires work inside the conversation.
It does. No, and I think you're exactly right. And it doesn't come natural, right?
No.
I mean, I think, unfortunately, for most of us, when somebody, you know, offers a view that's different than ours, you know, we want to jump in. We can kind of feel ourselves leaning forward almost, ready to respond and tell them why they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in complex, you know, issues, whether it's in an organization making a decision, whether kind of you're creating something together to be viewed by others, you know, simply shooting them down is never going to get the job done, right? It's
mm-hmm.
If we take the organizational example, you know, this person has some set of experiences and knowledge and data that have led them to this conclusion. And if I just view it as my job is to shout them down until I have, you know, overpowered them, then I'm not learning what their perspective is, right? I'm thinking, oh, we all see things the same way. If only they had my knowledge, they'd agree. Well, maybe they have some really different knowledge, right? And so asking that question, pushing and making sure you understand where they're coming from before you get into the whole back and forth really sets, you know, the dyad or the group, whatever, up for success.
Yeah, well, and because what we tend to fall into is judging others by their intent and judging ourselves by our actions. Because we don't know what they're necessarily thinking. And I think I read this, that the best listening is actually not to be quiet. You know, it is actually to ask questions, get clarity so that people know that they're being heard in the moment.
Absolutely. You know, you want to play back what you're hearing because, I mean, it does a couple of things. One is it validates the person talking to you, and so they appreciate it. Two is it makes sure you're actually understanding them, right? That, you know, it may be you think you know their logic because, like you said, you're running it through your own filter.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you really push back, oh, so you're saying this because of the following, it's, no, that's not at all why I'm saying this, right? You've, you know, kind of jumped four steps down the line. Let's kind of rewind as we go back and forth. And so that, you know, art of the discussion of really active listening as we go back and forth is hugely vital. But I think it's left out of far too many conversations.
Yeah, well, we don't practice conversation. I think that that seems silly to people when you're sort of like, isn't that how our communication, isn't that usually the problem and wouldn't be good to sort of practice? So, I mean, I you know, that's just, you know, a sad reality. Okay. I was a soccer player. My brother was Kyle was an all-state goalie. I was a center forward, but the ethnic club team that I played with made me a goalie. So I have experience. You have this study, and I was like, this is great. And I'm fascinated by what you found when they studied goalie behavior during penalty kicks.
Yeah, this one's great. So, you know, it gets to this idea that we want to be seen doing something and that learning really often requires a chance for us to pause, a chance to reflect and recharge. And so in this particular study, they looked at goalies. It was professional goalies in Israel, I think. And first they looked just to see where goalies dove. And it turns out goalies, you know, in this study, they dove for penalty kicks to the left about half the time, to the right a little bit less, 44%,
mm-hmm.
And they stayed in the center kind of the remainder. And so if you think about it as a goalkeeper, right, penalty
mm-hmm.
kick, the ball set on the spot, you know, here comes the offensive player. Maybe you've looked at some data for tendencies. You're kind of looking in their eye where they're going to go. But at the end of the day, as the data shows, you jump one way or the other. Now, what's so interesting is if you look at where the ball actually goes, over a third of the time, about a 39% of the time in this data, it went right back up the middle.
Hmm.
The player just kind of booted it right back where the goalie had been. And so what that suggests is that even though the goal is almost never stayed in the middle, that a viable strategy would be, you know, stay put more often. Then if mm-hmm. they push it to one side, you dive. If they put it all the way in the corner, it still goes in. If you stay in the middle, then you're more likely to stop the ball some of the time, right? And so that's not saying always stay there, but mix it in as a strategy. I think what's so interesting in this study is the researchers went back and they talked to the goalies. And they said, hey, here's the data. It says, you know, you should work this in. What do you think? Will you do it? And basically what the goalie said is, you know, oh, that's interesting, but no thanks. And they said, well, why wouldn't you dive? Why wouldn't you stay in the center? And they said, well, if we dive, you know, and the ball still goes in the net, then everybody, you know, your face is full of grass and dirt. You know, who's going to give you a hard time? You have given everything you had to try to stop the ball. If you're just standing there in the middle of the goal, right, the ball looking, you know, then what the hell? Anybody can stand in the middle of a goal, right? How hard is that? And so there's this desire we have to be seen kind of acting. And unfortunately, it's not a good idea to be always on, right? That the research is really clear that if we want to learn, we need to take time to think. So doing is helpful, but so is, you know, reflecting, talking about what just happened. If we want to be productive, yes, we need to act, but if we are always on, if we're not getting our sleep, if we're constantly working 100-hour weeks, then the data is overwhelming in saying, hey, guess what? You're not going to get as much done as you think you are. And so this has gotten some press recently. Elon Musk out.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Right. And unfortunately, the research would disagree pretty strongly with
yeah.
it. Part of it would say, hey, you know, we think we can get by with very little sleep. And unfortunately, you know, of the folks who would say, oh, you know, I need less than 6 hours of sleep, almost all of them are wrong. It's a very small segment of the population that really can thrive on less than 7 or 8 hours of sleep. Ditto with the fact that we need to recharge, we need to interact with other people and do some fun things sometimes. And so, you know, while there will be stretches in life that we're working constantly as we get ready for that big project or production or whatever it is, and that's fine in stretches. If we are always on, then we're actually going to get less done.
Yeah, I remember having this conversation with Adam Grant because I was working on a TEDx talk, and I tried to script it the first time I did it, which is like not natural to me. I'm better sort of beating out my own stories and kind of knowing them. And he had sort of suggested, he's like, you know, procrastination can be your friend here, especially if you've got a good creative mind. So, you know, take time just sort of daydreaming about what you want to talk about and then come to it. And this was the best advice I could possibly get, because I really just, it's a matter of what you're saying, which is both things can be true, which is I needed to just take some time playing with ideas, whatever, not sort of getting them down. And then I needed to practice for a while and then go back to my sort of daydreaming. And the shifting actually made what I thought was a more effective way of getting to a good product.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. And unfortunately, all too often, you know, we overschedule ourselves, right? And so we don't give that little bit of time for brainstorming, for creativity, for thinking about, you know, it's okay, here's my 30 minutes to get this, you know, immensely creative project done. And it doesn't typically, you know, good for you if you manage to pull it off, but most of the time it's nonlinear and, you know, we have to take those breaks. And so, you know, I think what's so interesting to me is the most productive people, you know, don't schedule themselves to 100%. They actually leave time for that thinking. And to your point of kind of that procrastination, sometimes push it a little bit, you know, get closer to the deadline, see kind of what, you know, the creative juices pull together for you.
All right. So in a second, we're going to ask you for a yes and story, a time in your life where you might have said normally no, but instead you said yes and. But before we do that, I want to kind of run through a couple quick things here that I found in the book, because they connect to so many of our conversations. First, multitasking. Is it a thing? Is it not a thing?
Yeah, in general, it's not a thing. So we like to think that, you know, as humans, we can do multiple things at the same time, and we can't. We are not parallel processors like a computer. We're sequential processors. And so we do one thing, and then we switch to the next. And so, you know, the challenge there is you're far better off, you know, sticking with that one thing for a little while and then taking a break and switching rather than, you know, flip it. Oh, I can look at Twitter at the same time and Facebook. And no, you really can't keep your mind focused. There's a switching cost to all of that.
Yep. Talk to us a little bit about how expertise can actually be a hindrance to our learning.
Yeah, so it's interesting. We often think about it's a story of kind of specialization or variety. Mm-hmm. And you know what we see in the literature, if we want to learn, we really need to do both. That as we get deeper and deeper in our knowledge about a topic, that specialization, then yeah, we know more. Unfortunately, it creates two big problems. One is we have a tougher time taking the perspective of a novice.
Right.
So we know so much, we forget what it's like to be new at something. And so we may really struggle working with others. The other thing is that we get so dug into our task that we miss the changes that are taking place around us. So we did some research looking at cardiac surgeons when the FDA came out with some negative news, with some bad news. And the people that had the most expertise with that given procedure, who should have been best positioned to adjust, they stayed committed. They basically escalated their commitment. They kept going, using this task over and over again, this procedure, when there was cause to back it off a little bit. And so there really is a risk as we get into becoming an expert, that we push it too far. And that's where kind of variety, doing some different things, mixing things up is incredibly valuable. So you put them both. It's not either specialization or variety, but rather specialization and variety.
And lastly, so I've spent most of my life building these Second City ensembles, right, which are generally six people.
Yep.
Who – and we have an amazing track record, right? So, you know, I had Colbert and Carell in the same cast, Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, go on. And what – and they're usually together for about 2 years, literally, you know, eight shows a week. And they're incredible. And then one of the reasons so many alumni out of Second City become, you know, very successful is because they learn this sort of muscle of working with other people over a period of time makes you better. So then they bring them with them. So you look at 30 Rock or Parks and Rec and it's like, oh, it's loaded with people that they worked with. And you have some science to back that up.
Absolutely. So we think of learning often as an individual story, but as you're pointing out, it really involves others. And we need to think about the key role that they play. One of the elements is this last point around familiarity, that familiarity really doesn't breed contempt. The research shows over and over again that as we work with the same people, that we get learning and productivity benefits, that we get comfortable with them, that we know what knowledge they have, that we're more likely to listen to them. And you put all of this together, we're more likely to be creative and innovative as well. And so tremendous opportunity for us to, you know, whether it's an entire team or even just a couple of relationships in a team that we've worked together before, to carry that through with us as we move on.
And am I correct in that there's not as much literature as there should be on studying like teams that have been together to see how effective they are?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that, you know, from a research standpoint, we struggle with, you know, getting large samples of teams.
Right.
And so that's something that has happened more recently in some of the work that I've done and others looking at, you know, in software, looking in consulting, looking at legal teams, looking at nursing teams. And in these contexts, we see this value that comes from keeping folks together.
Yeah, because the hard thing to sort of measure is you need a lot of numbers of people to, you know, validate the science. But really, the most effective teams are smaller groups of numbers, right? It ceases to be a team when it goes beyond like 10.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, take your Second City example, right? I mean, you don't have 100,000 teams that you've run, right?
No.
You've got, you know, approach and a small number of teams. And so it's a tremendous success. But, you know, we can study those qualitatively and like you have and see some amazing things. But doing large scale empirics, I mean, that's just not the right sample.
So interesting. All right. So I want to hear a yes and story from you. So, you know, we know when you're working without a script, which is what you kind of do every day, that the default behavior is often to say no or do nothing. And I'm wondering if you had a moment where you had to yes and something.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that the one that comes to mind for me is actually the decision to go back into academia. Hmm. So had kind of submitted an application only to Harvard, where I'd done my MBA and had, you know, kind of wrote all the things and then sort of forgot about it. And it came back and it was kind of late in the spring. I had a job already, and my wife was expecting our first child. And we sat down and we looked at this and we said, well, you know, what happens if we go go back to school? And it's like, well, you know, basically after 4 to 5 years, I'll get more or less the kind of a job that pays me as much as I have right now. And what happens if this doesn't work? Well, I'll get a job that's no better than what I had like 7 years ago. And so kind of as we were talking, kind of we made our list and it got longer and longer on the no side. And then kind of my wife, you know, nudged me a little bit. She said, well, why'd you put the application in the first place? I said, well, there's a chance to understand learning. There's a chance to answer all of these questions that I always have. And, you know, she and I just kind of looked at each other at the time we were living in Florida and realized that this was one of those decisions that made no sense, but at the same time made perfect sense. You know, now, I guess 15 years later or so, it's put us down a path that has been immensely enjoyable.
I love it. That's a great story. The book is called Never Stop Learning, Stay Relevant, Reinvent Yourself and Thrive. Brad Stotz, thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going